following podcast will contain spoilers and explicit language. Hello and welcome to episode 32 of
Yeah, It's That Bad.
My name is Joel.
And I'm Martin.
This is a show that looks at supposedly bad movies and asks the question, is it really that bad? And what that boils down to is that we look at movies that are rotten on Rotten Tomatoes and we reevaluate that score. Does it really deserve to be that low? Tonight's movie is 2009's Knowing, directed by Alex Proyas, starring Nicolas Cage, Rose Byrne, Chandler Canterbury, and Laura Robinson. Knowing is a 2009 science fiction film. This movie currently holds a 33% on Rotten Tomatoes. What a plot synopsis.
A professor named John Kessler deciphers a coded message with terrifying accurate predictions about every major world disaster. Looking to protect his family and prevent future calamities, he enlists the reluctant help of Diana Wayland, daughter of the now-deceased author of the prophecies. His quest to understand the messages of his own family's involvement in them becomes a heart-pounding race against time as he faces the ultimate disaster.
Martin, what's your history with Knowing?
I first saw Knowing in the theaters. I walked out.
You did?
Yeah. You didn't know that?
I must have blacked that out.
All right. I saw Knowing in theaters. Let's just say that I walked out with a feeling of levity.
Euphoria?
Euphoria. Yeah, just like giddy happiness from this beautiful adaptation of a wonderful metaphysical joyride.
I had the opposite reaction to this movie.
What?
So let me set the stage for what happened here with me, this movie. So my friend was getting married and I was in the wedding party, and we had done the bachelor party like on Friday or whatever. The night before the wedding, I guess it was on Saturday, I don't really remember. The very night before the wedding, instead of like everybody getting rested and going to sleep and waking up
on a washing machine like I did in college.
Yeah. And instead of like getting ready for this important day that we were going to start in the morning, we all decided to stay up and watch Knowing. And by the end of it, you have never seen an angrier room of men in your life. Like, we were ready to kill each other. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it got ones all around.
Really?
Like, straight ones from everybody. I think maybe one person might have given it a two. It pretty much was hated by everybody in that room. It was unbelievable.
Even Kevin?
I asked Kevin last night what he thought of this movie. He gave it a one. He hated it. And I was really angry at this movie. So I'm going to put out, like, the blanket warning like I did for The Wicker Man. Like, if you have any interest in seeing this movie at all, I highly recommend not listening to this and wait, see the movie first, because this is one of those movies that really benefits from not knowing. From not knowing what's going on. You're much better off going into it fresh, especially with me, because now that I've seen it a second time, the first viewing of this movie is completely different than the second viewing. So it's one of those movies. All right, Martin, let's do what we always do at the top of the show, and we'll discuss the actors one by one and see how you thought they did. Let's start with the little kid, Chandler Canterbury.
I'm glad you brought him up. I think I have a note very specific to him in here. Yeah, I have this kid's a dick. He's probably the worst actor alive ever.
His line reads are pretty poor. Is it really fair for us to bash a 6-year-old kid's acting?
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're going to play with the big dogs, like
if you're going to play with Cage, if you're going to play with Cage,
you better bring your A game, no matter how old you are. All right, Rose Byrne. She was like the mom.
She had what, like 15, 20 lines in this movie?
Yeah. Not much to say.
Yeah, so
that seems to be a recurring theme, like with the movies that we've been watching. It's like they have these female characters, but they have nothing to do. They have nothing to say. Is it the genres that we're picking, or
maybe it is?
Like, I feel like every movie that we've brought up, like the past like 10 movies, with the exception of like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, like every female character has just been there for like just as a two-dimensional.
Can you even call them a female lead? You can't, can you?
She's supporting.
Supporting actress?
Yeah.
There's not much support.
So, all right, let's just go right to the king. Nicolas Cage.
The king?
Yeah, so, you know, when it comes to Nicolas Cage, it's a real crapshoot. You never know what you're going to get. So, which Nicolas Cage were we visited by in Knowing? We got Dour Sad Cage.
We got Dour Sad Cage.
And then Melancholy Cage.
And then, as the movie progressed, his face just kind of came unglued, and we started getting the
Wicker Man
Rage in the Cage.
You never know. Even in the same movie, you
didn't say the movie is two different people.
Yeah, you don't know what you're going to get with this guy.
I'm like, is this even the same actor? His face was out of control towards the end of this movie. It was, you know what? It was impressive. Jim Carrey, I think, was probably sitting down and taking notes on some of the facial
expressions. Oh, his rubber face?
Rubber face. He was like, wow, Cage is really taking it to them.
You know, the thing with Cage in this movie, it was just like the Wicker Man. Like, he didn't have anything to do except be sad and freak out every 30 seconds. That's all he had to do in this movie.
But he's the best at it.
He did it with award-winning grace and dignity. All right, let me get into the very brief history of Knowing. Knowing was originally written by novelist Ryan Douglas Pearson, and the project was set up at Columbia Pictures. Both Rod Lurie and Richard Kelly, ooh, that's your boy right there.
Yes, it is.
Richard Kelly were attached as directors, but the film eventually went into turnaround. The project was picked up by the production company Escape Artists. Director Alex Proyas was attached to direct the project in February 2005. Summit Entertainment took on the responsibilities to fully finance and distribute the film. The director hoped to emulate The Exorcist in melding realism with a fantastical premise.
The Exorcist? I fail to see the similarities between these two movies. One is about the possession of a little girl by Satan, and then this movie is about the earth exploding.
Yeah, but he added realism with fantastical elements. You might as well compare this to Ghostbusters.
Set out to accomplish what they did in The Exorcist. What kind of fuck would that even mean? Sometimes I think directors just like make shit up, I guess, like to tell the media so that it sounds like it sounds artistic.
Sometimes they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
All right. So Knowing, let's dive into this thing.
Okay, so this movie opens up. It's 1959, and essentially there is an assignment in class in a grade school to have this class write down what they believe the future is going to look like. So they all draw pictures, and they put in a time capsule that's going to be dug up 50 years in the future, 2009.
And the kids draw like little like rocket ships and
other types of futuristic things.
And somebody drew a picture of me and you podcasting. they really nailed it.
It was like extremely well. It was very detailed. Essentially. They bury this time capsule, and this girl is writing down a series of numbers on a sheet of paper. She is maddeningly scribbling.
Whatever.
She's feverishly scribbling on this piece of paper. She can't stop. It's almost like she's in a trance. And then it cuts back to where this girl is now missing, and they find her in a closet scratching her fingernails away at.
And remember what she's hearing while this is all happening.
Right. She's hearing these bizarre whispering noises.
It sounded like that, right? So we fast forward to the future, and they open this time capsule. Lo and behold, Nicolas Cage's son gets this piece of paper with all these numbers on it.
A series of events now transpire that defies anything that makes sense to me. Somehow Nicolas Cage puts scotch on this paper, and it leaves a little ring of like condensation on the numbers. And somehow, wherever he dropped the scotch, it like circles 9/11. The next series of numbers is the number of people that died. And then he's up all night.
He cracks a code. You know, while this is going on, we get some insight into Nicolas Cage's family life. And there's a couple of things I want to point out here. So a lot of people were complaining that in Skyline, the main character was doing the face-off thing where he was like rubbing his wife's face or whatever. Everybody knows what I'm talking about, like the face-off, face touch.
Yeah.
It's just this really lazy screenwriter's trick, making the audience know that these two people have a deep connection. So they give them this stupid secret handshake kind of thing. And Knowing is no exception. So Nicolas Cage's son is deaf or not? We're not really sure.
I think like one of his ears is damaged. He has a hearing aid in like one ear.
Yeah, he wears a hearing aid. And so the little kid knows sign language. So Nicolas Cage does sign language with him. It's like, me and you forever. I could have done without this. I didn't like them giving them the secret code to each other. It keeps popping up throughout the course of this movie. It's like, all right, I get it. They're father and son. Isn't that enough? Like, I don't need this silly stuff added on top of it. Nicolas Cage has his son. He's got these numbers. And we see this sequence where we see what Nicolas Cage does for a living. He's a teacher at MIT. And he's giving this lecture to kids where he pretty much flat out explains that he's an atheist. And he doesn't believe in fate or chance.
Yeah.
And everything is just random.
Yeah. He's non-deterministic or whatever.
That's like the moral of the story. He cracks the code of these numbers and he's like, oh, wow. These numbers all signify with some sort of major event in the world. And it tells you how many people have died. So he runs off and he tells his colleague about it, who is, of course, doubtful, as anybody else would be. Like, this is just insane.
I find this to be the hardest to believe.
What?
That you're given a sheet of random numbers and your immediate response is, what is this? And then you just try to solve it?
Yeah.
I would probably just throw it out.
That's a really good point. Like, that's the movie. movie's over.
The movie's over. He just throws it away. Let's say that you were a father and your kid opened up a time capsule and just got a sheet full of numbers. You'd be like, "What the fuck is this?" And then you just toss it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The little boy thought it was a code.
That's even weirder. I would have took it from him and threw it out immediately. I'm like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" I think he has OCD or something, and I'd probably throw it out. Anyway, so back to the numbers.
Okay, here's another thing about the numbers that I thought was a little suspect. So we're led to believe that these numbers predict all major world events.
Yeah, but like then there's 81 people dying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
like, this is not a very major event.
Yeah, yeah. Supposedly, this little girl predicted when Nicolas Cage's wife died. How is that a major event? Only 46 people died. Like, why is that of note? Why would the Oracle need that?
Yeah, in a hotel fire of all things.
I feel like that many people die, like in the Middle East, like
every 5 minutes.
Like 9/11 being on there. Okay, fine.
Yeah, fine. 449 or whatever people die. That's
what is the threshold? I mean, you think like the amount of numbers that she would have written would have been astronomically long, right?
Right.
For only 40 people.
It would probably take up more than one sheet. I'll give you that.
Yeah. So eventually, Nicolas Cage, he figures out that these missing numbers that he didn't understand at first, they're latitude and longitude. So this little girl in 1959, she knew the exact day, the exact number of casualties, and the exact location in the world where these events would transpire.
Does she know them, or is she going into like a trance? She's being used as like a medium.
That's what I'm guessing is happening, because she's hearing all those voices, like they're giving her the information. But then the question is why? Like, what purpose would that serve? Yeah, so when Nicolas Cage figures this out, he realizes that the next event is today, the present. And not only that, he just accidentally, inadvertently ends up right where he needs to be to see this event.
It's raining, and apparently there's some type of car accident or roadblock or something up ahead. Nicolas Cage gets out of his car and starts to speak with a police officer. At that point, a police officer gawks.
Everybody listening to this, once again, close your real eyes and open your mind's eye.
Open up your third eye.
Yeah, and see if you can picture this. So Nicolas Cage is directly facing a police officer. The police officer is looking at Nicolas Cage, and behind Nicolas Cage, theoretically,
is the highway.
The highway with a bunch of cars. So Nicolas Cage is talking to this cop, and this cop looks up behind Nicolas Cage.
Essentially,
and he sees something that terrifies him,
like Cloverfield reaction.
Yeah, like, oh my God! And he
turns around and sprints in the other direction.
Now remember, he looked directly behind him, and which is the highway and the cars.
Right. So
when the cop runs
off, it's 180 degrees opposite direction of Nicolas Cage.
Exactly. So Nicolas Cage turns around and he looks up into the sky, and the camera pans up to the sky, and there's nothing there.
And then it pans 90 degrees.
Yeah, literally, an airplane appears in like the cop's blind spot where he never would have been able to see it.
No one was looking at it.
Yeah. Essentially, this cop ran away from nothing.
He was terrified by an overcast sky and a traffic jam.
So the camera pans a sharp right and we see this airplane coming out of the clouds, and this airplane just crash lands in the field. And we're treated to a Children of Men style single take shot where Nicolas Cage runs through the rubble and like helps all these people that are on fire. It was really cool looking. They did a good job.
Visually, yeah, it definitely adds something to the scene. I really liked it.
What are the odds that Nicolas Cage just happened to be there at the first prediction?
It's at this point in the movie where I'm curious if this movie is pro-rapture.
Yeah, because we haven't gotten to this point yet, but this movie is... Would you say it's a religious allegory?
I don't know how else you could spin this, because, I mean, there is symbolism all over the place.
Yeah, this movie is really heavy with the religious symbolism. I think that might surprise some people when they come into this thing.
There was nothing about it advertised in any of the previews or any of the promos for this movie, but there's like a huge religious aspect to it. For me, I thought it was really interesting. If you're not expecting it, if you're just like looking for a sci-fi thriller.
Yeah, about natural disasters.
Yeah, this is going to go.
This is throw you for a loop.
Yeah, this is not going in that direction.
That's one of the big problems I had with this movie the first time I saw it. It's just like the sequence of events that this movie kind of walks us through, it just gets more and more and more outlandish as things progress.
At this point in the movie, we've already been introduced to these characters that essentially don't speak. They wear all black. They're very similar to like...
They're the Men in Black.
Yeah, from the Mothman Prophecies book.
Yes.
That's like how they behave. And they've given Nicolas Cage's son like a vision of hell on earth.
In the middle of the night, Nicolas Cage's son is visited by this man dressed in all black in his bedroom. He creeps in like... Yeah, like the ultimate pedophile sneaks in and like shows him this vision of massive forest fire, all these animals running around on fire, a CG moose burning up
Yeah, yeah. Essentially, everything is being burned alive. It pans out and shows the horizon, and literally everything is on fire. It's like the earth is on fire.
Yeah, so this kid is viewing this from inside his room through this little window. Why would you show this to like an 8-year-old kid? Like, what's there to be gained from that?
You know what's really interesting about that? I'm glad that you brought that up. Later on, we find out that these characters are benevolent.
Yeah.
Like, why are you doing that to this little kid?
Extremely traumatized. That would cripple an adult psychologically. You're showing that to an 8-year-old boy.
Who's already like lost his mother. He's already psychologically damaged. Like,
hey, guess what?
Guess what I'm going to show you? Everything else dies. Everything is going to die. Check it out. It's in the one place that you feel safe, your bedroom. I'm going to make it. You're safe nowhere. Let me show you.
Yeah, so these people, they're called the Whisper Men. No, they're called the Whisper People.
They're called the Wicker Men.
Oh, yeah, they might as well be. Yes, they're called the Whisper People, and they're called it because we never actually see them speaking, yet Nicolas Cage's son, the little girl in the beginning of the movie in the 50s, and this other little girl that we were introduced to later, they can hear them in their mind. They hear them whispering.
Yeah, what they're supposed to be hearing is like a gift of the Holy Spirit, which they explain later on in the movie, but that's what all this whispering is. It's you're able to hear angels speaking in tongues.
This is your interpretation.
No, they literally show like Ezekiel's wheel, like a biblical image, and then Nicolas Cage speaks to his father, and he's like, he talks about the gifts of the Holy Spirit, like the gift of prophecy.
Oh, that's true.
The gift of speaking in tongues. So,
okay, all right.
So, I mean, I don't really think it's just my interpretation. I think that it was pretty heavy-handed.
Okay, all right. It's around this point where a switch flips in Nicolas Cage's head.
And he's no longer depressed college professor, and Nicolas Cage dons on his traditional
Wicker Man bear suit.
Wicker Man.
And he goes buck wild. First, he grabs a baseball bat. He runs into the woods. He's like, come here! And he starts bashing trees with the baseball bat. And then Nicolas Cage, he grabs his gun from Bad Lieutenant. Remember how big that gun was in Bad Lieutenant? This gun was even bigger. And it looked so fake. It didn't even look like a real gun.
And then you said that it looked like the gun wasn't even in the scene. That they just like edited it in post-production. They put a CG giant gun in his hand.
Yeah.
This leads him on a trail to the daughter of the little girl who wrote this prophecy. And Nicolas Cage gets his creep on.
He does. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he essentially stalks this woman to a natural history museum in the Boston area. He essentially uses his son to like get an in with this woman. He like says, he's like, go over and flirt with this little girl or whatever. Nicolas Cage was like, oh, looks like our children are having a good time. And she's like, yep, looks like they are. Yeah, you want to go, you know, you like going to museums? They get to talking, and Nicolas Cage, slip of the tongue, lets her know that
he pretty much accosts her.
Yeah, he's like, this didn't happen by mistake. I sought you out. And she's like, holy shit, I gotta get out of here. Which I think is a normal reaction to someone who you meet at a museum when you're taking your little kid to like
see the animals
or whatever. And this weird guy comes up to you.
Yeah, and he's like, your mother, she had a gift, didn't she? She could see the future. And rambles on these insane theories that he has.
I mean, I feel anybody would just run away.
He wins her over.
They end up going to the mother's old trailer in the middle of the woods, right? Is that where this is?
Yeah, her dump. Yeah, so they go into the house that belonged to this old woman, and it's like a dump. There's crap everywhere, and then they find this pretty cool drawing, Ezekiel 1.
Yeah, it's where Ezekiel's wheel is shown, and then apparently God visits Ezekiel and brings him into heaven. It's the scene where Ezekiel is literally brought to heaven on a fiery chariot.
Yeah, I actually looked this up today just to see what it was all about, see how this compares.
I think I just said
to the movie.
I think I just said it's the scene where Ezekiel gets taken. Like,
that was a great scene in the Bible.
That was a great scene in the Bible when they took Ezekiel to heaven.
Who directed that? Yeah, so that this is where all like the religious stuff is really coming into play, because that pretty much spells it out right there. Like,
yeah, that's blatant. On the sheet of paper, there's two digits at the end that Nicolas Cage can't fit into the longitude, code. Latitude, or the rest of the code. And it's just what looks like 3-3.
Yes.
But essentially what happened was this paper was taken out of this little girl's hands and buried in the time capsule against her will. So it was turned as she was writing. It wasn't a 3-3. It was an E.
Nicolas Cage lifts up the bed and etched, just like in The Wicker Man, somebody etched a creepy message underneath a piece of furniture.
Everyone else
So apparently the last date of the prophecy is the end of the world.
The global apocalypse.
Yet again, another super global megapocalypse movie brought to you by ESFN.
I feel like there's better ways to go about informing people that everyone else dies at this point than etching it into the bottom of your bed.
Yeah, so that's it. And the end of the world is like days away, apparently. What's he gonna do? What can he do?
Okay, so it's at this point in the movie that Nicolas Cage somehow comes to the conclusion that the weather that they're experiencing in October that is unseasonably warm is the result of some type of solar activity. He immediately rushes back to MIT to run a simulation of what's going on. And comes to the conclusion that there's going to be a giant solar flare, gamma ray burst, coronal ejection.
Yeah, it was something like that. Solar maximum.
Solar maximum, coronal ejection, whatever. Yeah,
basically what it looks like, it's like, the best way I can describe it, it looks like the sun sneezed. Like a choosh, and it shot a hot fiery blast out of the earth. That's what's going to happen.
Whatever the case is, they've predicted it like a day or two in advance. It doesn't take that long. Like, it takes 8 minutes for sunlight to get to Earth, doesn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's no way it would take 2 days for this to get to our planet. I thought that was, like, literally insane. They're like, and he goes, we have to inform Noah. Again, another disaster movie where Noah is brought up. Two in a row.
Two in a row. No Dennis Quaid to save us this time, though.
That's actually why everybody died in this movie. Dennis Quaid wasn't in it. If Dennis Quaid was in it, he would have.
Or John Cusack. He could have been really helpful.
Yeah, he would have drove his limo and blocked the coronal ejection. Anyway. In any case, he would have drove his limo into the sun. He would have launched off the earth and drove it into the sun.
Say that what's about to happen.
There is literally nothing you can do.
No matter how deep you are underground, there's no way to escape it.
I think Nicolas Cage states that it will liquefy the crust a mile underground. It'll turn it molten. I mean, there's no escaping this unless you were to go to like another planet or whatever. You had a rocket ship or you were to send like your son to, another planet.
Another planet. Sure. Go off world. That's
the only way
is that feasible in this movie?
Okay. So Nicolas Cage then runs out of this house where everyone else is essentially etched on the bottom of the bed because the two children are being it looks like they're about to be molested by the whisper people. This is when Nicolas Cage gets his bat out and starts hitting the tree and he follows them into the woods. It's at this point where the angel opens his mouth as wide as he can.
Oh my God.
And shoots like a headlight?
This guy is standing there in the middle of the woods. He opens his mouth and like a laser beam shoots out of it. This was a bad idea. This was not a good idea.
There's a lot of things in this movie that are ridiculous.
Like, again, try to imagine this from the perspective of a person that's never seen this movie before. So we start off with this kind of interesting plot of this little girl predicting the future.
Right.
Like, through via numbers. That's interesting. Now we're in this part where there's secret beings who are shooting light out of their mouths and Nicolas Cage. Really? How do these two go together? They don't.
I gotta admit, like, unless you've seen the end of this movie, you can't reconcile that. So, like, going through it the first time, it's like, what the hell am I watching? What
is this? Now, here's the question I have about this movie. So, they made a big point in the beginning to be like, okay, Nicolas Cage says when he's talking to the kids, he's like, the universe is a random place. There is no fate. There is no chance. But then he gets these numbers. You know, he starts to believe in fate and chance. And he starts to believe that there's something that he can do. And now we're back full circle again. And he comes to realize that there's nothing he can do. The world is just this random place. Things happen. Tough. So what am I supposed to get from that as a viewer?
Who is this movie for? Is this for Nicolas Cage? Are all these events happening for him? To be completely honest, Nicolas Cage, the mother, none of these people needed to be in this movie. They could have just got the kids and left. I'm sorry, I'm going to like spoil the end of the movie. The entire objective of this movie is to get kids off of this planet to start a new Eden. It, as insane and ridiculous as that is,
where we started, where it was a little girl with numbers predicting world events. And this movie ends off with what we think are aliens or angels, depending on what you want to believe. Yeah. They come and they take Nicolas Cage's kid and whisk him away into outer space.
To another planet, and it just shows a giant tree of life.
We're not making this this up. Like, I mean, really, I mean, stop not, and think about that.
It's not even a symbol. It literally is one lone giant tree.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen a picture of the tree of life in the Bible, it is like they just copied it.
Yeah.
And put it plop right in the middle of this scene. Beautiful angelic music and fade to black. What the fuck?
This movie feels like three different plots colliding into one. And if you were to separate these three into their own movies,
it would be interesting.
So we have subplot one of these natural disasters on a piece of paper, subplot two of this mysterious race of people that are stalking these children, subplot three is the exodus from Earth by aliens or angels to another planet. These are three completely separate elements that do not gel with one another.
They're very interesting on their own.
Yeah.
You could almost make three movies out of all of them.
Yeah.
They should have made three movies out of them.
No, but instead they decide to cram them all into this giant clusterfuck of a movie.
The reason I enjoy this movie is because I have a
sick fascination with the macabre.
I have a fascination in arcane hermetic symbolism. Okay? Macabre? Yeah, literally. That's like a very personal thing for me. Like, for somebody else watching this movie who, like,
doesn't give a shit
about that. I mean, they're gonna be like, what the fuck is happening?
All right, can we step back for a second and talk about this natural disaster? So everyone else, like this girl said, everybody else is gonna die, and just the fire just obliterates everything. Which, by the way, looks really cool.
They did
a good job. The end of the world sequence in this movie is very cool looking. It's worth seeing just for that.
It goes building to building, then it zooms out and shows the entire New York City area. New York.
There are other cities to blow up.
There's other cities to blow up, please.
Now, this leaves me with a kind of moral dilemma. I'm not alone when I sometimes get annoyed at seeing like a happy ending, like a forced happy ending to a movie.
Right.
I'm kind of at odds with myself with this because this movie's ending is extremely bleak and fatalistic. Yeah, there's nothing you can do. Oh, well, movie's over. Everything you tried to do to save it was a waste of time. You might as well have just sat down and done nothing. That's a problem too, because like, what was the point of anything that happened in this movie if everything was just going to be wiped out anyway at the end? Why do we watch all that other stuff?
Which is why I'm saying, what is the purpose of these numbers? Is it to change Nicholas's... The only thing that changed in this movie was Nicolas Cage from being an atheist to believing in God and reconciling with his family. That is literally the only thing that changed by these events. That's a really weird thing about this movie. Usually, like, the protagonist in the movie does something where they can actually, like, save people.
Yeah, the numbers are meaningless. They serve no purpose. Did he really need to know that there was going to be natural disasters?
No, because it didn't do anything.
Yeah, there's a part in the movie where there's another natural disaster. It's a train crash, and Nicolas Cage goes there under the impression that he can solve it. Like, he doesn't know what the disaster is, but he just goes thinking that he can stop it, and it turns out, you know, you can't do anything at all. There's nothing you can do.
No, everything is predetermined.
So why even have a movie at all? I think that's a legitimate argument.
It is
like,
because
why even bother? Like, why did I watch this 2-hour long thing or whatever?
This is a movie about biblical determinism, okay, which is really ridiculous for such a fucking stupid storyline
for a Nicolas Cage flashlight movie.
It's about biblical determinism. Okay, wow, I cannot believe I'm tying this into it. But again, this is why I like this movie.
At the end of this movie, when Nicolas Cage's kid gets taken up in God's chariot. Or
in the Merkaba?
Yeah, when he gets taken away, Nicolas Cage goes to hitch a ride. He's like, I'm getting out of here. So he tries to get on the ship, the alien spaceship. The alien angel whisper person says, no, only the children can go. All right, okay, great. Then why were you molesting this little girl in 1959? She's not going to be a kid by the time the world ends.
You ruined this little girl's life, and then you ruined her daughter's life.
That's true.
Made her insane, killed her. Oh man, these people suck.
Why save the children of the earth? If you're going to judge the human race as a whole and say, let's wipe them out, do them all, right? What are you going to start over with kids?
Why are these kids different? Yeah, what the fuck are different about these kids? There's the same shitty model that you're destroying. It's not like they're...
They're just going to emulate their parents, right?
Right. It's not like their minds are erased when they get to the planet. This kid has a locket of his dad and mom.
Whew. This is, without a doubt, the headiest movie we've done so far.
Right.
Whew. Real mind trip. Okay, Mar, so that was Knowing. Let's find out what the real critics have to say about this movie. Now, Martin, you're a fairly educated young man.
Young lad?
Yeah, let's see if you can discern a pattern in these reviews. The movie begins shameless, grows stupid, and winds up silly. If the ending had less of the air of a crackpot religion and more pretentiousness, you could almost call it Shyamalan-ish.
Whoa.
Kyle Smith, New York Post. If you want to know how inept the movie is, well, it's so inept that you may wish you were watching an M. Night Shyamalan version of the very same premise.
Man.
Owen Gleiberman, Entertainment Weekly. And finally, its breathlessness and permanent state of confusion make you long for the assured touch of M. Night Shyamalan. Kamal Al-Solyali, Globe and Mail. Okay, did you catch a pattern? It's very subtle.
Yeah, I caught it. How do you think this makes M. Night Shyamalan feel? Just like out of curiosity.
He's like a butt of these guys' jokes.
He is the scale that somebody measures a shitty, ridiculous movie off of. Like if it's really shitty and insane, you're Shyamalan-ish. Like, they turned his name into a derogatory term.
Okay, Martin, this movie currently holds a 33% on Rotten Tomatoes. Is it really that bad?
Not at all. I was entertained the whole time. I've seen this movie probably around, I don't know, 7,000 times. And every time I've seen it, I'm enraptured. I thought it was shot well, and for the general public, they're not going to like this movie. I've tried to get them to see it. I mean, I showed it at work, and like my coworkers were like, turn this piece of shit off. I'm like, guys, it's great. Look, angels.
If you could project this on the moon so everyone on Earth was forced to watch it,
I would. I would do it. Knowing full well that everybody would be angry and upset with me. I would do it anyway.
All right, so what's your score on this thing?
4 out of 5.
Ah, wow, that's rock solid.
Yeah.
I think it's an amazing coincidence that we have just been watching all these disaster movies. Like, we watched The Day After Tomorrow, and then we watched Knowing. And at the same time, we just got blasted with an earthquake here on the East Coast.
And we're about to get slammed by a Category 2 hurricane.
Yeah, so what's going on? I wonder, is Mother Nature guiding our hand, or are we guiding hers?
Joel, stop it. You're scaring me.
I'm being very Shyamalan-ish. Okay, so as for me, is it really that bad? You know what? Had you asked me back in 2009 or whenever the hell I watched it the first time, yes, I hated this movie. Absolutely hated it. I hated everything about it. It was so obnoxious, so annoying. Now that 2 years have passed, I've kind of softened towards this movie. I'm going to bump this up to a tenuous 3 out of 5. I enjoyed it a lot more this time than I did the first time through, which that's always interesting when that happens, right?
I'm glad you're coming around. I'll see you on the other side, Joel.
We're going to have a suicide pact?
Yeah.
All right, we got a voicemail about this.
To listen to your messages, press 1.
Hi, guys. This is Ratman from Iowa, and I've been listening to your show for a while now. It's pretty cool, and I want to offer up my little review of Knowing. It's probably going to be pretty crappy since it's been a while since I've seen it, but the thing I remember about Knowing is it's difficult Cage. You know, the way he acts. And I remember him trying to save these kids from aliens. But the thing that always stuck out the most to me about Knowing, and I think that's why I tend to forget the rest of the movie, is the ending. And that's because I was totally expecting some sappy, weird ending where he saves the Earth. But no, he doesn't. And you get to see the Earth get destroyed. And I thought that was an amazing ending. I might be weird in thinking that, but I just thought the ending was great. And as far as the rest of the movie, I wish I could remember the rest of it. But that's basically my little review of Knowing. Pathetic, I know. Thanks, guys.
End of new messages.
Thanks for that voicemail.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, Martin, let's read some listener mail. Miles writes in and says, hi again. Been meaning to send this for a while. Thanks for putting me on the air again. I wanted to make a correction. You mentioned the remake of Red Dawn. I have been keeping track of this as the original was so buggy. The villains were supposed to be Chinese, but they got mad and they were replaced with North Koreans. I don't think anyone outside Kim Jong-il's sphere of influence would give a fig about a story portraying the glorious People's Republic of Korea in a negative light. I would be a little surprised if someone had not mentioned this accuracy yet, but just in case they haven't, keep up the good work. Okay, well, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, Rishi Dave writes in and says, now this is interesting. This is going to give people some insights into the world of the podcast a little bit, I guess. I listened to your podcast for The Happening. You guys busted out laughing so much and then cut it out very abruptly. I think you should definitely leave a little bit of the laughter in. It definitely fuels the laughter further. Now, we got this email from Michael. He says, "Hi, I'm a big fan of the show and have listened to each episode. One thing that continues to annoy me is the fake laughter that you both, but one of you in particular, feels the need to do several times in each podcast. It is really okay if you laugh at something that I do not find as funny. I am not talking about that. I mean, there are several occasions where your laughing sounds loud, forced, and fake. Can you please take a note and try not to do it so much? Thanks."
None of our laughter is forced. I mean,
none
of it. We're just very jovial people.
That's what I wrote back to him. I said, like, if you hung out with us in person for real,
you would get really annoyed because we laugh constantly.
What you hear on the podcast is, I would say that the podcast is probably, 95% accurate to how we are in real life. The only difference is that the podcast is kind of sped up because of the editing.
Right. It cuts out any, like, dead space between our speaking.
Yeah, but it's pretty,
this is essentially how we are when we hang out.
It's like distilled to what we are like this is really how we talk to each other, and the laughter is real. Now the question as to cutting it off or leaving it, do you remember when we first started the show?
Yeah, we got blasted for laughing. That was like one of the first negative responses we got on this podcast, was that the laughing was overwhelming.
It was too much,
and you're like, let's tone it down a little bit. So since then,
we laugh. Whenever we laugh, we pull away from the mics. That's what I've learned.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm turning my head when I'm laughing. You're pulling away a little bit. And then also, I think, like, are you still doing it editing-wise? Are you still toning them down a little bit and cutting them?
Yeah, I cut them down for...
And you also lower the volume occasionally,
sometimes,
right?
Yeah. Sometimes if it gets too much. But yeah, that's why, because we kept getting too much negative feedback. That's why I cut out the laughing.
Like, as far as this podcast goes, like, viewer feedback, it's made it what it is.
So people complain, I listen. So there was an overwhelming demand.
Is the laughing forced? No.
No.
Why do we laugh? We laugh because we're making each other laugh in real life. And should we laugh more or less? I think that we kind of like reached a happy medium.
Just to give people insight into the editing, when I leave the big spike laugh and I cut out the like the trailing ending.
Yeah, because no one wants to hear that.
Yeah, because that doesn't add to anything. Like, let's move on. That's pretty much it. So there you go. There's two opposing viewpoints on a very important issue.
Extremely important.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the question of the week. And the question of the week was essentially, who's your favorite movie dad? Because Dennis Quaid was just the world's greatest father. And Paul writes in and says, who would be a great dad from a movie? What better than someone who not only looks and sounds cool, but is feared by pretty much everyone in the universe? I'm talking, of course, about Darth Vader. Yes, he was a whiny bitch when he was human and couldn't act his way out of a paper bag. But when we were kids, who didn't want him as a dad? I mean, really. When you ever had the whole my dad can beat up your dad argument, you would always fucking win. He had a red lightsaber and choked everyone who pissed him off. You know, he'd teach you all that one day. Okay, Tim writes in and says, favorite movie dad has to be Mr. Mom. Michael Keaton is hilarious, and this movie rocks. As a soon-to-be father...
Wait. Michael Keaton is hilarious. Okay, go. Continue.
As a soon-to-be father, I plan on basing all my parenting on this movie.
Oh my God.
God help us all. Anonymous writes in and says, favorite movie dad? Ben Affleck as Ollie Trink in 2004 Kevin Smith film Jersey Girl. It's surprising that this film got a bad rap, but I actually like this movie. Shannon writes in and says, I'm going to go old school on you. Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. I've always thought he was a terrific character who taught his children to stand up for what was right, no matter how unpopular it was.
Tom Cruise thought that also in Vanilla Sky, because he based his father off of that character.
That's Atticus Finch. You're right. I also have a good one for the worst movie dad of all time. John McClane from Die Hard. He's a superb action hero, but a shitty father, husband, and cop.
That's a great point. He's a shitty cop. He's a bad cop.
Okay, Little Dave says, Jackie Gleason from The Toy. Anybody who gives their kid their very own Richard Pryor to play with kicks ass. Christopher said, my favorite movie dad would have to be Chris Gardner from The Pursuit of Happiness, played by the brilliant Will Smith. He was the embodiment of what every great father should be. The things he did and suffered through so that his son would have a better life were incredible. Paul writes in and says, Ariel's dad, King Triton from Disney's The Little Mermaid. Four reasons why. One, he's ripped. Nobody will make fun of you because he's got your back. Two, he's got stellar facial hair. He makes long beards and bushy eyebrows look good. Three, he carries a trident. Again, nobody will mess with you if your dad's back home polishing a three-pronged weapon. And four, he can grow in size. And that's just cool. For all those reasons, he's a badass dad, but my God, who would want to date Ariel knowing that guy is her father? I'd be afraid if I brought her home from a date too late, I'd get my ass kicked by King Triton. Also, let me toss Mufasa into the mix here too. Another great Disney cartoon dad. Rest in peace, Mufasa.
Wow, R.I.P. Mufasa.
Yeah. And finally, Anonymous said, the best dad is the dude from Big Lebowski. I mean, he doesn't have a kid per se, but they do imply he did knock up Maud. I mean, have you heard of the Seattle Seven? He was one of them. Plus, good stories for when he was a roadie for Metallica. So there you go. Thanks, guys. If you want to reach us, you can contact us at yasthatbad@gmail.com. Okay, now as for this week's question of the week. Now, like I said last week, I kind of threw out a request for people to come up with suggestions for the question of the week. And I'm going to pull another one from that list. This was a pretty good one. Okay, so straight from our Facebook page, Wesley writes in and says, what director would you hire to make the movie of your life? This is a pretty good question. Like, what do you think, like, the style of the movie would be? Who would you hire?
Christopher Nolan. That's not even hard.
Oh, it's just going to be this epic, mind-bending thriller?
Absolutely.
I'm hiring Wes Anderson. I want it to be quirky as hell.
Really? Your life's
going to
be
claymation if he wants, you know?
Really? It's going to be quirky? Are they going to line up everybody from your life on a boat?
Yeah.
And are they gonna have like the scene of your house like as like a cutaway?
Yeah, man. Wes Anderson directs the Joel story. I'd pay for that.
Would Ben Stiller be in it?
He'd be me. then,
who would?
Owen Wilson will be you.
I'm Owen Wilson and Ben Stiller.
All right, so there you go. That's the question of the week. What director would you want to direct the movie of your life? And what would that movie be like? Head on over to yasthatbad.com. Leave a comment on this episode's page with your answer, and I'll read it on the show. Okay, now's the time to announce the winner of the listener's choice poll. The choices were
Sucker Punch
versus
Ghost Ship.
Yeah, Emily Browning, one of our original patron saints back from the dead.
And the winner is
Sucker Punch. You guys went with the
Zack
safe.
Snyder explosive.
Yeah, they went with the safe choice. Tune in next week when we will be watching Sucker Punch. And if you've already seen Sucker Punch, give us a call at 973-797-9324. Leave us a little mini review and we'll play it on the show. Okay, thanks for listening to the show. If you like what you've heard, please consider subscribing. We have a new episode every Tuesday. Please leave us a positive review on iTunes. Those 5-star reviews really do help out the show. Head on over to yasthatbad.com and click the like button.
Clicking the like button on Facebook lets other people know
about the show.
This great podcast. It,
that really does spread the word of the show. Like that's like legit. That really does help. You can also follow us on Twitter at @yeahitsbad. Oh, and once again, we've recently been picked up by Stitcher. So head on over to Stitcher.com so you can listen to our show on your BlackBerry or Android or any of those other wacky non-iPhone/Zune devices. So once again, if you got a buddy who has an Android phone or a BlackBerry or whatever, just tell them to download Stitcher. Okay, once again, thanks for listening to the show. See you next time.
And the winner is
Ghost Ship.
Ghost shit.
Well played.
Thank you.